From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for that support. We hope you will keep it up, and if you haven't been a part of it, that you'll become a part of it. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, December 26th is the Zoroastrian observance of Zarathustra, and Sunday, Catholic Christians mark the Feast of the Holy Family. Merry Christmas, everybody. I hope this weekend finds you and yours safe, without want, and able to celebrate the holiday in the company of loved ones. There's nothing like that. Next month, we celebrate a remarkable milestone. 10 years of State of Belief Radio. As things slow for the holidays, we're taking the opportunity to bring you some of our favorite segments from that decade of broadcasting. But first,
in her new book, Grounded, author Diana Butler-Bass argues that faith isn't on the decline, it's just transforming. People are connecting with God in different unconventional ways and are finding spirituality in the world around us, not just in the church pews.
It's always exciting when a new book from theologian Dr. Diana Butler-Bass comes out, and this time is no exception. In October, Harper One published Grounded, Finding God in the World, a Spiritual Revolution. The follow-up to her acclaimed recent book, Christianity After Religion. This woman writes so well and so powerfully. This time of year is perfect for the kind of hopeful, living faith that Diana exudes every time she's with us on this show. And I'm very happy to welcome her back to State of Belief Radio. Diana, thanks for being with us again.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This is one of my favorite places to show up whenever I have a new book come out.
Oh, good. Well, let me tell you, I personally found your last book, Christianity After Religion, to be a very encouraging work. The idea that challenges can help a denomination grow spiritually more than complacency in a time of success does. That was a welcome response to the voices saying progressive organized religion is dying. I see this new book as a logical next step in focusing on the presence of the Holy in everything around us, and that finding that holiness is kind of the next step in a process of liberation. Now, is that way off base from what you were doing, or am I getting some of it?
Well, you know, it's so wonderful that you say that, because you are the first person I have talked to who gets the connection so quickly between the two books. Grounded is very specifically written in response to questions I got from Christianity After Religion. And I will never forget the day that I was with a group of Presbyterian ministers, and I was talking about the hopeful aspects of all the trends regarding religion, which most people see as very depressing. But I was saying, hey, this is an opportunity. You know, this leads us to a deeper reflection on our faith. And I wrote about all of that mm-hmm. in Christianity After Religion. But then the last section of Christianity After Religion, the final three chapters, I argue that it's more than just a transformation, but that all of these things point towards the idea that we might be entering into a phase of awakening, mm-hmm. that extraordinary moment in American history where everything changes and where our sense of citizenship and our sense of faith are renewed at a deep and profound level. Mm-hmm. And so I was with this group of Presbyterian ministers, and they were talking about the first two sections of the book, and I stopped and I said, you know, it's interesting to me. Everybody wants to talk about the trends of decline, And everybody likes talking about the theological questions that might be emerging. But I said, nobody wants to ever talk about awakening. And the Presbyterian minister raised his hand. And he said, that's because we don't believe you. And I was sort of stunned by this. Mm-hmm. But what it pointed out to me was people don't believe what they can't see. And I thought to myself, okay, well, if he doesn't believe me, that means I haven't been clear enough in painting a picture of what the contours of this awakening might be. And so that was really where Grounded came from, out of my old work, was what might be the shape of awakening. And as I have been arguing for a long time, that has to do with spiritual experience. You use the beautiful old-fashioned word holiness. I talk about the sense of the sacred that is all around us. It has to do with that, the relocation of God in our lives, in the world, and in the communities in that we inhabit. And that means for me, and I'm so happy you saw it, Grounded is actually the next chapter of my work. It stands on its own. Many people can just pick it up and read it and go, wow, this is a really great and wonderful book. But if people have read my work over the course of the last dozen years, it is the next book.
Diana, how long has this been going on in you? And it takes you way back, I'm sure, from even far beyond where we were talking about this morning. What got you thinking about these lines in the first place?
I think it goes back to my own experience in the 1970s. And I was born in 1959. So in the 1970s, I was a teenager. And we moved from Maryland, where I was born, to Arizona, which meant I was dislocated from my family's traditional church experience. And that move made me have to answer a whole bunch of questions about faith and religion for myself. And part of the sort of questioning that began to occur to me when I was a teenager was that the institution of which I was a part, and that was my family had been United Methodist for several generations, the institution of which I was a part was not communicating spiritual experience very well. And instead, as a teen, I kind of fell in with a whole bunch of other teenagers, my friends, who were interested in evangelical religion. And so we would go to Christian rock concerts and spend Saturday nights at these kinds of really cool sort of hip 1970s sort of revival meetings. And I would also go with friends of mine, Roman Catholic charismatics, to this wonderful place called the Franciscan Renewal Center in Scottsdale, and it was great music and prayer. It was kind of like today, but much more Pentecostal oriented, because it was the 1970s. And so here I was, 14, 15 years old, and I was seeing the split between institutional religion, which was my family's great and deep tradition. My family was very active in the Methodist Church. And the fact that those institutions seemed to be missing the energy and power of this renewal that was bursting out everywhere among younger people in the 1970s. And so that was really my first sort of experience of this question between institution and spiritual experience. And I wanted the two things to come together. And I could never figure out how that could be. And I think that basically I've spent an entire personal spiritual faith journey trying to figure out that question, but also an academic career in studying American religion about the tensions between institution and lively faith.
So where are you on that today?
I feel like a teenager again. I think that happens when you get into your 50s and your own kid is getting ready to go off to college, you know? Yeah, and there's part of me that just feels I don't know. Maybe I'm, like I said, I'm just getting a little bit older and I'm kind of frustrated and a little tired. And I am longing for communities of rich, rich experience of faith. And they're pretty hard to find. And so I think right now I'm kind of just at a moment of being a little blue about the institutions. Even though I work with them regularly, you know, I consult with any number of bishops and dioceses and denominations of all sorts. But they're in trouble right now. And the main thing that's better than the 1970s is that they know they're in trouble. And when you know you're in trouble, that means you're going to have to depend on wisdom and something that's sort of maybe even outside of yourself in order to get to a new place. And Christians, we often refer to that as the Holy Spirit. So I am hoping that the fact that they are in so much trouble and that they know it is a step towards genuine wholeness and reconnecting the pieces that are broken.
How do you, in talking with those people, consulting with them, and then in your own reflections, how do you see spirituality manifesting itself in what you call the grounded world? When you talk about a grounded world and the kind of spirituality that you see as authentic and I see as authentic, how do you describe where that shows up? Does it show up in institution or does it show up spontaneously in individuals or outside in other institutions rather than the church? Just, it's a very open question.
The book primarily, you know, it's really written from a personal angle where I show how these, how God is showing up in my own life, my own experience. And I, when I started asking myself the question anew, you know, in my early 50s as I was thinking about this project, I realized that it wasn't so much an issue of, you know, heading off to the Franciscan Renewal Center, going to the Christian rock concert on Saturday night, but I was really finding the presence of God among my neighbors in different forms of human interaction and community. And I was also discovering God in a very amazing, fresh, and kind of new, really new way for me in the natural world. And so the book is divided into those two halves, into finding God through nature and finding God through our neighbor. And I don't think that that's particularly original. There are a lot. There are about 1,000 books on finding God in nature, and probably another 1,000 about finding God in your neighbor. But the original piece is that I try to put them together.
Right.
And I don't make them competitive stages of sacred activity, but instead I say that this is part of the spiritual ecosystem in which we all live and move and have our being, and we're dependent upon it. So when you ask about the word institution, I think that this idea that we now live in an ecosystem or an environment of neighborliness and nature is that institutions are having to understand themselves relocated within that kind of system or that kind of environment, whereas institutions used to think of themselves as kind of outside of these things, that they could control the environment or they could control nature or they had sort of the whole idea about how to have the best kinds of programs to meet the needs of our neighbors. And so institutions didn't really understand themselves as part of a web of life. And so in Grounded, the primary sort of switch for me was understanding my own life, my own spirituality, and God as part of this web of the universe, the web of the cosmos. And the call is for institutions to discover themselves anew as part of this rather than apart from it. And I think that if churches, we're talking about faith institutions here, churches and synagogues and mosques, really understand that they make up the ecosystem rather than they're trying to fix it from a distance, that that's going to change their orientation towards themselves and towards God. Mm-hmm. And so I think that what we're looking for at this moment in history is, in some cases, a renewal of much cherished institutions to be able to adapt and respond to the shift in the way that we're structuring the universe.
Yeah.
And then in some other cases, we're going to need some new institutions. And so I think that that's just kind of the question that's before us all together. You know, it's a question about religious institutions. It's a question about schools. It's a question about politics. Mm-hmm. It's a question about our economic institutions. Will the institutions we have be able to adapt to a new moment, or will those institutions be replaced by eventually new structures and new institutions? And we just don't know the answer to that question yet.
Right. Well, it's interesting.
But it's exciting because I mean, part of what I argue is that God is with us in this whole endeavor of life here on planet Earth. And so the implication is, of course, that we don't have to, you know, dream up these extraordinary institutions that are going to fix everything, but instead we simply have to respond to the call of God within our culture, and that's going to lead us in the direction of healing and wholeness.
Dan, I'm interested in the fact that this book comes out at a time when many faith leaders and communities are focusing on environmental issues, and obviously the natural world is important in this book you've written. What's the connection between the biblical call to be good stewards of the earth and the meaning that you ascribe to the world around us on a spiritual level?
Well, the Bible, of course, opens with the book of Genesis. And I, in recent years, I have come to love the first three chapters of Genesis because it talks about, you know, this sort of cosmic vision of creation. It's like, as Walter Brueggemann says, it's a great cosmic liturgical poem. You can't get away from the majesty of all creation when you read that first chapter of Genesis. And then you get into Genesis 2 and 3, and oftentimes in American religion, Genesis 2 and 3 have been read as, you know, the particular story of the creation of men and women and then of the fall. You know, that, oh, everything was wonderful, but then something terrible happened. We sinned and God kicks us out of the garden. Well, I think that people are learning to read Genesis 1 through 3 with new eyes. Mm-hmm. And instead of it being a story about a fall, it's a story about a call. And the call is to this first couple who are created from dirt and breath. And I love the Hebrew words of Adam and Eve are really Hebrew words, Adam and Hava. And Adam means soil, and Hava means life or breath. And so what the Genesis is pointing to for us is that everything that is a gift of soil and life, a soil of soil and breath, that the whole rest of the creation comes about because of the union of Adam and Hava. And so with that, we creatures of soil and breath, of soil and life, are called to be, and you use the word stewards, which is a lovely word that Christians began to use in the late 19th century to describe our call towards the earth. But Larry Rasmussen, who taught for many years at Union Seminary, he suggests that that word is better translated as overseers. Now, overseers has some particular resonance, and that's not very good in American history due to slavery, but it also has this other resonance that's actually quite theologically beautiful, and that is the word overseer is the same word that's used in the Christian New Testament for bishop. And so are we called to be, in a sense, the bishops of all of creation? And that is an extraordinary idea of vocation.
Yeah.
that men and women are called into this role of service, into this role of forming communities, into this role of really embodying the presence of God in the created world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what a bishop is supposed to do, technically. And so this idea that we have oversight, this role of bishop towards the whole of the world, the whole of the universe, to me, that becomes the new story of Genesis and the one we have to be telling over and over and over again. Hmm.
Diana, when you and I talk, I'm convinced that the people here that run the studio speed up the clock because we're almost out of time and I'm not out of questions. But I've got to ask you one, and I need just a succinct answer, though it deserves more than that. I think there are two levels. That there is the really substance of the book that is so helpful in itself, but you also communicate the message to your readers that religion is a process. It's a progress. It's never really done, and you wrap it up. There's discovery and doubt and honesty. If 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you read this book, how would you critique it today? And then?
Oh, my gosh. I think I would have been fascinated by it.
Uh-huh.
I certainly would not have been in exactly the same place theologically.
Uh-huh.
I would have still been a devotee of the distant God on a throne in heaven,
mm-hmm.
Which I talk about at the beginning of the book. But I also think I would have been enthralled
mm-hmm.
by the possibility of such deep intimacy of the power of God with all of us here in the midst of creation. I have always been a person who's been interested in kind of mystical literature and the world's great religions, and even when I might not have theologically understood them all,
mm-hmm.
I always found them compelling. And what I think my book is a very contemporary, very down-to-earth, very ordinary kind of mysticism for people in the 21st century to say, oh, my gosh, God is here. And what does that really mean for my life? And I would hope that I would have had that response 20 years ago, and I hope that people now will have that response to what I've written.
You know, I actually think they would, was asking that question, I was imagining the way I know you and the answer, and I think you would have read it, you would have been excited, and you would have said, you go, girl, I want to know more about that.
and I would have set myself on a 20-year path to figure it out, because that's just what I do.
Oh, Diana Butler Bass is a popular public speaker. You can see why. She's an independent scholar specializing in American religion and culture. She's the author of 9 books, including the acclaimed Christianity After Religion, The End of Church, and The Birth of a New Spiritual Awakening. Her latest is titled Grounded, Finding God in the World, A Spiritual Revolution. I recommend it highly. Diana, it is always enlightening and interesting and rewarding to talk with you, and I thank you for being with us once again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
It was years of work for Dr. Jana Rees to distill the Bible into 140-character-long tweets. Along the way, she discovered deep meanings that spiritual language may have hidden for some. She also found plenty of humor. The project has been published now. It's in book form. And a couple of years back, Jana was with us for the holidays with the 12 Tweets of Christmas. Here's part of that conversation. Since we're well into the Christmas season, I was hoping you would share some seasonal scripture in Twible form.
All right. Well, so I chose 12 tweets of Christmas, and these are taking people through the birth of Jesus all the way through the resurrection of Jesus. So as you can imagine, there's a lot that's left out, but I hope this will get the gist of the story and be entertaining too.
Okay.
All right, the 12 tweets of Christmas. One, just when you thought we'd left the Old Testament, here's a string of begats to put you at ease. Ancestry.com says JC's descended from David. Woot! Two, astrologers are sent on a field trip to find a Messiah child somewhere out west. Quote, a star. Could you be more specific? Unquote. Three, teen girl Mary, chosen by G to bear the Savior. Okay, the pregnancy raises some eyebrows, but a double thumbs up to Joseph for loyalty. Four, quote, ma'am, the rooms are full at Bethlehem Inn, but there's a rustic barn out back that is quite charming, and the hay is complimentary, unquote. Five, Taste of Galilee is a hit when J.C. feeds 5,000 people with 5 loaves and 2 fish. Can he also multiply chocolate cake for dessert? Six, J.C. uses his own saliva to heal a man born blind. So the first thing the guy sees is a stranger spitting on him. Hello, cruel world. Seven, J.C., quote, love one another as I have loved you, unquote. It's really not much to ask, you know, just be willing to die for others. Oh, there's that. Eight, J.C. raises a girl from the dead. Good thing she was only 12. If she'd been a teen, she would have slept all day until she wanted to get up. Nine, the 12 freak out when J.C. wants to wash their feet, but at least he doesn't use his own spit this time. That's progress. 10, there's nothing funny about Jesus dying on a cross. Sorry, catch up with me in the next chapter.
Oh.
11, doubting Tom mauls J.C.'s wounds to make sure his resurrection's the real deal. J.C., quote, ouch, couldn't you just take my word for it, unquote. And 12, J.C. to Pete, quote, do you love me with agape love, unquote. Pete, quote, sure, I friended you 3 times on Facebook, unquote. J.C., quote, fair enough, feed my lambs, unquote.
You know, that's kind of an annotated twibble. You've got scripture and you've got Jana's commentary, and you did really well. And I know that there's more than one congregation in this country that would welcome an abbreviated version of the Christmas story and all the rest. So, Jana, talk briefly about the process of curating the multi-year Bible tweeting project into book form.
I like the word curating. That's a wonderful thing, because I think that is a lot of what's going on here, taking the gist of a story, trying to distill it down to its narrative, but also trying to make it fresh and entertaining to people in the culture that we live in today. Not always easy. Some of the passages were a little bit hard to relate to modern life, especially Leviticus, for example, or the mm-hmm. Book of Numbers. But some of it is just timeless and wonderful.
The hard work of taking something that we all think we know well and then reworking it into a different form can provide truly unique insights. There's an element of a monk painstakingly hand-lettering the Bible in ancient times to your work. What did getting this intimate with the Bible do to you? Did you find something new? Did you feel something different?
I found new things almost every day. You know, there are 1,189 chapters of the Bible, which is a long time of your life if you're tweeting it out one chapter a day. And so that pace required me to spend a lot of time with the text and also with commentaries so I could see what other people were saying about it. And so, yes, I learned a ton. For example, I learned something that I never knew about the first temple in Jerusalem, which was that it was probably only about 2,700 square feet. we think of this temple, you know, Solomon's temple, as being a huge, grand, amazing wonder of the ancient world. But in fact, it was not that large. You know, you could fit about 100 of them in a Walmart supercenter today. Hmm. So thinking about that in scale was really interesting to me. I learned a ton.
What do you, when you think about a reader going through your book, talking about the Twible, what do you hope readers get out of that? What do you want them to feel or think when they put it down?
Well, that's a great question. A couple of things. The first is, I want them to laugh. I want them to have a wonderful time with the Bible. I think people are so many times so intimidated by the Bible and kind of afraid to try it, or they feel that they should know more about it than they do. So the Twible, you know, seeks to entertain. And then the second thing I hope is that they will be educated. You know, they will leave this reading experience not only laughing, but more informed about the Bible and looking at it as an overall story rather than just trying to understand little tiny bits of it, but getting the bird's eye view of the whole Bible. I just had a pastor buy 20 copies of it for his confirmation class, which I thought was wonderful. You know, he thinks that it's a good way for 8th and 9th graders to understand the Bible and to not think of the Bible as something that's boring or something that's for other people, but something that's for them.
Dr. Jana Rees is a scholar, a writer, and author. Her latest project is, and write this down because you may want to give it to someone as a gift from you. It's a great gift. Her latest project is The Twible, all the chapters of the Bible in 140 characters or less, now with 68% more humor. You may even think it's more than 68%. I've described Jenna's work in the past as irreverent but always respectful, and that certainly continues to be true. Jana, it really wouldn't be right for us to do a real long interview with someone as interested as you are in getting it abbreviated. So let me just say Merry Christmas and thank you for once again being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much, and I wish you the best of Christmases.
Same to you. From time to time, we entertain some of our friends and some new guests that we've never met to come and talk with us about special times, special holidays in various religions. At Christmas time 2012, we first aired this very special conversation with Rabbi Brad Hirschfield, president of CLOW, the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. You're going to really like this again, I think. Jewish Americans have nowhere to hide from the total immersion, pardon the word, in Christmas that dominates our culture this time of the year. So what can they do?
Well, the first thing I would say is I don't think we have anything to hide from. And I mean that both on a cultural level and also on a spiritual level. What I mean culturally is that one of the things that I truly love about America is that nowhere in the history of the Jewish diaspora over 2,000 years have Jews lived as comfortably, not just alongside, but along with people who are Christian, people who are Muslim, people who are atheist, Buddhist, every possible tradition. And so I would really tell any Jews who feel a need to hide, that impulse to hide is a kind of denial of the magnificent history and present we have had and the future I think we can share, which has nothing to do with diminishing or the weakening of Jewish bonds, but has everything to do with appreciating that our roots can be quite deep and we can still be quite open in this culture. And that for me is a profound blessing.
But Brad, you know, and I know that we Christians at this time of the year can be so single-minded that we are at least a bit, if not a lot, obnoxious. When you get the full dose of Christian music and all of that. And how do they handle that?
Well, there are a couple things. And first of all, I think context counts. I live in New York City. If I lived in Chattanooga, I'd have a different experience and therefore a different response.
Right.
And I do think that's important because it speaks to something, Welton, I know that you are careful about and have championed on behalf of others, which is that the larger the majority, the more sensitive that majority needs to be mm-hmm. to the needs of minorities.
Mm-hmm.
And so in New York, basically, it's all kind of a wash. I'm sure I love Christmas because we're a wash in Hanukkah too. And yet, if I lived in a community in which there were only a few hundred other Jews amongst hundreds of thousands of faithful Christians, it's a different experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess my guidance would be, first, is I try and remind Jews that while there is no truth in that, in the obvious sense, to the idea that people say, oh, yes, Hanukkah is the Jewish Christmas. No, it's not. But it is. And here's how it is. I think it is no accident that these two traditions, and there are others, I think it's in the core of Kwanzaa and other winter observances as well, promise their members, their believers, their followers, that we can all find the light and the warmth we need, even at the darkest and coldest time of the year, even at the coldest and darkest moments of our life.
Mm.
And so while there are profound differences between celebrating Hanukkah and celebrating Christmas, try and see in others what you love most in your own tradition. And I think on this one, it's not even that much of a stretch.
Mm-hmm.
From a burning menorah to a lit-up tree to the promise of a little jar of oil, which is at the core of the Hanukkah story, how the oil lasted longer than anyone expected, to the promise of a largely unknown baby in a manger and people imagining that that baby could and would become the Messiah. And at some level, that doesn't have to be a claim theologically, because imagine if we lived in a world where we came a little bit closer to treating everyone's kid as if they were going to be the Messiah.
Mm.
Imagine what that would mean for issues of child hunger and illiteracy and all the other things that whatever divides us deep down, most people, right, left, religious, secular, Christian, Muslim, Jewish, Buddhist, all know, you know what, we should do better on those things. We can do better on those things, and we must do better on those things. So that would be the first response. And then the other is I ask the Christians, try and invite a little participation from someone who isn't just like you. It's not that you should be less overt in the celebration of Christmas. I actually like that stuff. I like it when people wish me a Merry Christmas, because if that's the language of blessing that's near to their heart, then share it. But make sure you make it okay for someone who's not like you to wish you a happy Hanukkah or a happy Kwanzaa or whatever else they're celebrating. Because for me, we're all at our best, not when we cut off or silence parts of who we are, but we make sure that others who aren't like us can be just as present and just as visible as we want to be.
My friend, you know that for many around the world, it's been a year, it's been a tough year, a year that involved loss and suffering. Many have known violence. What are some of the Jewish teachings that are applicable when getting ready for the end of a year like this one?
I think I'll stay close to home in the sense that I'll look at the Hanukkah story. It's this old story, a couple thousand years old. When those Maccabean soldiers went into the temple in Jerusalem, it had been ravaged by war. The menorah, the seven-branched candlestick that lit up the temple, that now we celebrate with eight because it's 8 days, the holiday, and they saw a little bit of oil that wouldn't burn for very long, and they decided they would pour that oil into the candelabrum and light it anyway, even though they couldn't possibly know if it would last. For me, the miracle that the oil burned 8 days didn't begin when the oil burned 8 days. It began when those first soldiers said, you know, let's try. Let's dare to act as if a miracle could happen, and maybe it will. And I think that you combine that with the idea that actually, what if we really believe that each of us is also like that jar? That you and I hope, and certainly everyone listening, we all have more within us, more ability and greater gifts than we often realize about ourselves and almost certainly ever realize about each other. And what if we dared to treat each other like those jars of oil? And I think that that really is what allows us to say, okay, we know if it doesn't work, the truth is it shouldn't have worked anyway. But it's amazing if we're willing to believe that it might and act as if it might, how often it could.
Oh, that's really great. I want to ask you a personal question. What do you like to do on Christmas?
Oh, God, there are a couple things. First of all, I do like to go with my kids and see Christmas lights.
Mm-hmm.
And especially one family that we've been friendly with. The truth is the family we met who in a childbirthing class, and I can't believe 20 years ago. And we became very fast friends from very different backgrounds, very different religious backgrounds. And without even really planning it, an amazing tradition evolved where they would always come one night of Hanukkah and light a menorah and give gifts and get gifts and eat latkes, potato pancakes with us. And my kids would go shopping every year for a tree ornament for their tree.
Hmm.
And it's a funny thing because, right, I'm an Orthodox rabbi whose daughters go shopping for Christmas tree ornaments. And I tell the story because I can honestly say at no time do I ever worry that it will diminish or dilute or confuse my kids. What I think they've actually learned is that when you love who you are really deeply, with real security, with a strong sense of attachment, it will allow you to love who other people are, even though it's not exactly you. I don't imagine any circumstance in which the Hirschfeld house will have a Christmas tree. But I also don't want to live in a world where anyone in the Hirschfeld family can't appreciate a Christmas tree's beauty.
Mm, that's just tremendous. Please tell me that I'm right about this, because all of the Jewish members of the staff of the Interfaith Alliance do two things, and it seems every one of them does it. They go eat Chinese food, and they go to a movie.
Yes, Chinese food and movies are definitely a big deal. There's no, and I have to confess, typically it's a bigger deal the more traditionally Jewish you were raised. I was not raised in a terribly traditional home, so we often had lots of non-Jewish friends and went to Christmas dinners, and my parents were never bothered by that. So, but typically, you're right. I think what happened is, and now we're full circle, where could Jews, especially in a time in America where there wasn't quite as much understanding
mm-hmm.
and affection across traditional lines, where could Jews go to kind of get out of the way of the Christmas onslaught?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you go to a Chinese restaurant, because even if the Chinese people running the restaurant are Christian, they're a different kind of Christian, and who really knows? Chinese don't relate to religion that way, and the food is very different, so the whole thing is like a time out from
mm-hmm,
America.
Mm-hmm.
And in a movie, the truth is, the lights go off, and it's all about what's on the screen. And I think there is something to be learned from that, whether you go to have Chinese food or go to a movie, is that to remember whatever's going on, that's not all that's going on. And there are other cultures and there are other things to focus on. And so that's why the third thing I would add is that for a lot of Jews, Christmas becomes a volunteer option, a mm-hmm. service option, because there are a lot of people who would like to be home with their families to celebrate Christmas. And if it's not a sacred occasion for you, if you happen not to be Christian, the truth is there's another sacred activity you can engage in, and that's go take over the job slot of that doctor or nurse or firefighter or police officer who would like to be with their family, or go make sure that you will serve the meals and take care of the people who need to be cared for if their usual caretakers and servers want to be home with their families on Christmas.
Rabbi Brad Hirschfeld is president of CLOW, the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. Brad, as always, it's been a pleasure speaking with you today on State of Belief Radio. It's not just a matter of a good conversation. It's also a matter of great inspiration, and I am grateful to you for that, and wish you a happy Hanukkah and a Merry Christmas.
I wish you the same, Welton. It's really an honor to be able to talk with you. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. Thank you. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and all good things.
That conversation with Rabbi Brad Hirschfeld, president of CLOW, the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership, first aired on State of Belief in 2012, one of the more memorable moments during the 10 years State of Belief has been on the air. It was one I thought would be the perfect way to end this week's program. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, thank you, thank you, thank you. We rely on listener support to keep this show on the air. As the end of the year gets closer, and it's really close now, please consider a tax-deductible contribution to State of Belief and to Interfaith Alliance. If you heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, friends, acquaintances, please share that news with them. It's very easy to do on Facebook, Twitter, and at stateofbelief.com, and your endorsement of the show can be very important in making them regular listeners of this show like you are. Stateofbelief.com is also where you'll find extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.